from deep inside your radio.
Yeah, the place with the squeaky chair, ladies and gentlemen. We owe a certain degree of thanks this week to Mr. Douglas Feith. We'll get to that in a moment, however. First, the John McCain campaign has been at great pains to emphasize that the Obama campaign's assertion that McCain would offer just a third version, a third go-round of the Bush administration, Bush 3, is palpably untrue. McCain's campaign has been at pains, as I say, or McPains, to say, no, we're not Bush 3. We're a whole new thing. We're the change agent. Like change needs an agent. Boy, if change needs an agent, don't pay him 10%, my recommendation, because you won't get your... Anyway, so this week, there's a wholesale new team brought in to the McCain campaign, because things were going so well. So they brought in Steve Schmidt to replace their campaign manager, Rick Davis. Steve Schmidt, whose previous work was for George W. Bush. They also brought in Nicole Wallace, who's going to be traveling with McCain for communications expertise, formerly worked for George W. Bush. And they brought in Greg Jenkins to take charge of the staging of McCain's events after the all the complaints about his speech in Metairie, Louisiana, the same night Obama delivered his triumphant I won the nomination speech to thousands. McCain delivered a speech in Metairie, Louisiana to about 200 guys that looked like they were left over from the audience of the Wally George show. So a new guy has been brought in to stage McCain's events, Greg Jenkins, who last did advance work for George W. Bush. So no, in no way is it Bush 3, because we say so. Meanwhile, who's lobbying for the Kurds? The Kurds are doing pretty well. I don't know if you saw. The Kurds signed a side deal while the Iraq National Government is working on its oil deal. Thank goodness. The Kurds have already signed a deal with a Texas company run by a friend of George W. Bush. There's that name again. But there's some heavy-duty lobbying by the Kurds in Washington to make all this happen. Their lobbyist, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. Those two hats look good on you, Haley. And now to Douglas Feith, to whom we owe a debt of gratitude. Now, he was the former official in the Defense Department who set up the Office of Special Plans. Doesn't that sound, in retrospect, doesn't that sound like something just out of a really, really bad movie? The Office of Special Plans. What do they do there? But the Office of Special Plans, in this case, I can tell you what they did there. They were the people who funneled special intelligence. That is to say, things like Curveball, whom the CIA said was a fabricator. Well, that made it special. Special enough for Doug Feith's office to funnel it to the president and vice president to support the policy of the war in Iraq, of which Doug Feith was an early and avid proponent. You might say it was a Feith-based initiative. I just did. Anyway, this the debt of gratitude, I say, is this week Australian television, ABC television in Australia, did an interview with him. And I have to say that he there offered perhaps the clearest, not the most sensible, but the most crystalline explanation of their view in the administration of what the point of all this was. So here is Doug Feith on Australian television this week.
There was substantial evidence that Iraq was involved in the international terrorist network. We were focused not simply on retaliation for 9/11. We were focused on preventing the next attack. And so the president's view of the nature of the challenge after 9/11 was broader than punishment for 9/11. He said we have to look at the broader terrorist network, which meant various organizations, not just Al-Qaeda, and we had to look at all of the relevant state sponsors. And we needed plans to do the maximum reasonable disruption of the international terrorist network, which meant hitting the state sponsors and hit them in a way that would shake up the entire network of state supporters so that they could pull the reins in on the various terrorist groups that they had contacts with. That was a very important strategy.
Very important to upset the network. It was a network. It wasn't just a local station. It was a network. All these states sponsoring terrorism. This week in The New Yorker, Cy Hirsch repeats what's been known fairly well to interested observers for a while, but fleshes it out with new details, that an organization called MEK, located in eastern Iraq, which has been on the State Department, our State Department's list of terrorist organizations for about 10 years now, is getting assistance from the United States government for terrorist actions inside Iran. So if you're wondering where in the pursuit of the worldwide terrorist network and state sponsors of it we're going to go next, I wouldn't be betting on us attacking Iran before the election. I'd be betting on us bombing ourselves. Hello, welcome to the show.
You're shiftless and you're lazy, just like that hound dog Daisy. I had when Grandma raised me,
honey child.
Quit Granny, got too old to scorn me. Dear old Auntie warned me, you sure was no good for me,
honey child.
But your kiss is sweeter than the cake that Grandma used to bake. All them sweet little things about you, sure now take the cake.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, from the Crescent City, New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, we keep being told by these folks who appear to be in charge, the grown-ups, that, you know, the problem in the old days was that that old defective law enforcement model for fighting terrorism, that model that, you know, a tough version of it, obviously, but that model that ended up kind of beating terrorism in Europe. Dateline Indonesia. Indonesian police have dealt another hammer blow to Southeast Asia's most feared terror network, Jamaah Islamiyah, according to analysts. Raids netted 10 suspects in a safe house full of more than 20 bombs and computers, apparently appearing to stop a dangerous cell poised for a big attack, probably against Western tourists on Sumatra. The arrests are the most significant blow to JI since the capture of two senior leaders last year. But that's just a bad old law enforcement model. We don't want to be doing that. Ladies and gentlemen, interesting news this week. President Bush, a gaping chasm has opened between President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, usually believed to be joined at the hip, if not lower. The two are normally believed to share views on almost everything. But this week, as I say, at his 4th of July appearance at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia, President Bush revealed a gaping chasm between himself and Vice President Cheney. You know that in the last year, the vice president delivered himself of the opinion, as did his chief aide, David Addington, in testimony a couple weeks ago, that the vice president really isn't part of the executive branch. So he doesn't need to be bound by any of the rules that bind the executive branch, if there are any left. But here's President Bush at Monticello.
As a statesman, Thomas Jefferson held all three top posts in the executive branch. He served as the first Secretary of State, the second Vice President, and the third President.
Uh-oh. Vice President's in the executive branch, according to the President. Man, I'd hate to be at the next dinner between those two. And also, President Bush had this observation on the current population of the United States of America. Listen closely.
Throughout our history, the words of the Declaration have inspired immigrants from around the world to set sail to our shores. These immigrants have helped transform 13 small colonies into a great and growing nation of more than 300 people.
More than 300 people. I think we've got a lot of growth in store. I don't know about you, but I feel good about the future of this place. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Lucky he's not working for McDonald's. More than 300 served. NPR correspondent Robert Smith says he may have caused the confusion this week about what exactly happened during a Barack Obama campaign appearance in Zanesville, Ohio. News reports after the July 1st visit by the candidate suggested he declined to give a fist bump or terrorist fist jab to a boy at the Eastside Community Ministry, saying, "If I start that..." But video of the encounter soon showed the boy had asked Obama to sign his hand with a permanent marker, and Obama told the boy his mother wouldn't appreciate that. NPR correspondent Smith was standing nearby at the time, representing radio reporters in the press pool. He says he'd been making small jokes for several days about fist bumps. Enter the candidate and the schoolboy. Smith says Obama moved through the room shaking hands. "I'm supposed to be quiet at this point," Smith says, "but I turn to the other reporters and I say, I wonder if anyone's going to give him a fist bump." And about a minute later, we see this little kid come up to him with his fist out. And I'm like, look, it's going to happen. He's going to get a fist bump. Unquote. A reporter for an NPR who's I'm like. The room was fairly loud, Smith says, so it was hard to hear exactly what Obama says. Smith says it looks like Barack Obama is turning his back on the fist bump. He's no longer will do that, and he's disappointing a kid and all that stuff. If my joking aside about a fist bump in some way changed the course of this election and hence the American empire, says Smith, then I am officially sorry. And I'm like, okay. Dateline Istanbul, four Iraqi men are suing U.S. military contractors who say they tortured them while they were detained in Abu Ghraib prison. Lawsuits filed in U.S. court this week. alleging the contractors committed violations of U.S. law, including torture, war crimes, and civil conspiracy. The four plaintiffs were released without charge. They described their experience at an Istanbul hotel where they periodically meet their U.S. legal team. They gave accounts of beatings, electric shocks, and mock executions. Farmer Suhail Naim Abdullah Al-Shimari said he was caged, beaten, threatened with dogs, and given electric shocks during more than 4 years in detention. I lost my house, my family were made homeless and left without a breadwinner. I lost 4.5 years of my life, and all they did was say they were sorry. Fox News Channel Geraldo at Large made the decision last week to show exclusive video of the model who committed suicide in New York City. The video included images of her bloody, pale face with the rest of her body covered by a white sheet. Executive producer of weekend programming at Fox News, David Clark, says it was a producer error, and we deeply regret it. They're not apologizing for Geraldo, just for the footage. The former pastor of a Washington Borough, New Jersey church was sentenced this week to 3 years in state prison for concocting a fake lottery-style scheme to raise money for the church. Reverend Robert Acolese was sentenced to 2 counts of theft by deception. The priest will serve his time outside of prison under intensive supervision. Parish was suffering from financial problems, I wonder why, and was trying to start a school. So Ascalisi devised a Powerball lottery-type raffle that would generate almost $500,000 from ticket sales, of which $200,000 would automatically go to the church treasury. He purchased unsold tickets under fictitious names that won each lottery from 2000. I don't even understand this. Ascalisi apologized for any harm that came to the diocese. I gave 26 years of my life to the diocese and my congregation, he said. It was never my intention to be malicious. It was just a happy accident. The former chief executive of Refco Incorporated was sentenced to 16 years in prison for a financial cover-up that brought down one of the world's largest commodities brokerages. Philip Bennett, a British citizen living in Gladstone, New Jersey, said he didn't mean to hurt anyone. His voice cracked when he apologized to his family for their unimaginable agony. Actually, I can imagine it. Electronic Arts has apologized for a culturally insensitive blunder in its game UEFA Euro 2008, in which the Northern Ireland football team stand to the Soldiers' Song, traditionally sung at United Ireland sporting events. The official Northern Ireland national anthem is God Save Our Queen. Now, a very Irish song. Dateline Ottawa, Canada's embassy to the United States, apologized this week for a party invitation that featured Samuel de Champlain. An illustration of him, I think, not the actual Sam Champlain. He's long dead. But the illustration featured him brandishing a large plate of poutine. The emailed invitation to a Canada Day party on July 1st. Hey, belated Happy Canada Day, everybody. Showed Champlain, the French explorer who founded Quebec City, holding a plate of the dish, which, in case you didn't know, is French fries covered in cheese, curds, and gravy. Mm-mm. They didn't learn to cook from the French, did they? Just to talk from them. Jean-Paul Perrault, president of a French group, said the invitation was an outrage and an insult. He demanded an apology from Prime Minister Stephen Harper and said the foreign affairs minister should resign. If they wanted to make a joke, it's a really bad joke there. If it wasn't a joke, well, it's worse. He told the CBC, saying the invitation was equivalent to using a hot dog to promote English-speaking Canada. Yeah? Says embassy spokesperson, the Embassy of Canada changed the invitation. It was not intended to offend anybody, and we apologize if it offended anyone. A police force has apologized to the Muslim community after its ad campaign featuring a puppy sparked an outcry. Where is this? It doesn't even say. Dundee, I guess that's Scotland, a picture of Rebel, a 29-year-old black Alsatian featured on postcards promoting a new non-emergency telephone number, but the choice of the image, which shows Rebel sitting in a police officer's hat, was questioned because Islamic tradition warns against contact with dogs. They're seen as impure. They may keep the animals as guards, dogs, but not as pets. Dundee shopkeepers have refused to put the postcards up in their windows. We did not seek advice from the force's diversity advisor prior to publishing and distributing the postcard. That was an oversight, said the police spokesman, and we apologize for any offense caused. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. What's going on over in Pakistan? This week's confession, non-confession, revocation of confession, reconfession by A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistani bomb and the great proliferator, is a confession again. He now says Pakistan did provide centrifuges to North Korea, that bad old North Korea. This was in 2000 in a shipment supervised by the army under General President Pervez Musharraf. A.Q. Khan told the Associated Press in a telephone interview that the uranium enrichment equipment was sent from Pakistan in a North Korean plane that was loaded under the supervision of Pakistan security officials. Previously, we'd been told he proliferated kind of as a lone wolf, you know, sending him, I don't know, DHL. The claims contradicted his 2004 confession that he was solely responsible for spreading nuclear technology to Iran, North Korea, and Libya, and Pakistan's repeated denials that its army or government knew anything about Khan's proliferation activities. He said the army had complete knowledge now, he says, of the shipment of used P-1 centrifuges to North Korea, and it must have been sent with the consent of Musharraf. It was a North Korean plane, and the army had complete knowledge about it and the equipment, Khan said. It must have gone with Musharraf's consent. Khan's allegations are his most controversial yet and could prove deeply embarrassing for both the army and Musharraf, our ally. Musharraf's spokesman, Rashid Qureshi, rejected Khan's claims. I can say with full confidence that it is all lies and false statements, he said. All right, I'm taking that to the bank. I'm taking all of it to the bank. Meanwhile, right across the border in Afghanistan, this nation's top military official says more U.S. troops are needed there to tamp down an increasingly violent, or as the Pentagon said a couple weeks ago, resilient insurgency. But the Pentagon doesn't have sufficient forces to send them. Why? Because they're committed to the war in Iraq? Mm-hmm. This according to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, said the Taliban and extremist forces in Afghanistan have become a very complex problem, one that's tied to the extensive drug trade, a faltering economy, and the porous border with Pakistan, where they hide out. June was the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the war began there in 2001. Casualties there in June, and I think May as well, exceeded those for U.S. troops in Iraq. It's like they can move around. I don't have troops I can reach for, says Mullen, brigades I can reach to send into Afghanistan until I have a reduced requirement in Iraq. Wow, it's like he's calling for troop withdrawal or something, man. How irresponsible. That is the latest from our friends over there along the Iraqi-Pakistan, the most porous border, I guess, aside from more porous than ours, less porous, I don't know. But it's the border that you don't hear Americans, conservative Americans, saying we should do more to protect. And that's the good news. And now, ladies and gentlemen, another copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much, Inspector General Singers. And ladies and gentlemen, news of the Inspector General. The Pentagon has now ordered electrical inspections of all buildings in Iraq maintained by Kellogg Brown and Root, a major military contractor, after the electrocutions of several United States service members. Support our troops, won't you? General Petraeus told Congress of the new inspections while also disclosing that at least 13 Americans have been electrocuted in Iraq since the war began. In addition, many more service members have received painful shocks. Most recently, a staff sergeant died when he stepped into his shower and was electrocuted at his base. Officials now acknowledge Army experts warned as early as 2004 that poor electrical work by contractors was creating dangerous conditions for American soldiers. Those warnings, were ignored. The Inspector General will be looking into that of the Defense Department. KBR and other companies have been paid millions of dollars to repair and upgrade older Iraqi buildings, including their electrical systems. But no repairs were made. Operators of nuclear power plants have yet to comply with some of the government's fire safety rules 3 decades after they were issued, according to the Government Accountability Office. There were 125 fires reported at 54 power plants since 1995, an average of 10 a year. None threatened safe shutdown or posed any significant safety threats. But the GAO study said the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been unable to resolve several long-standing issues with the industry over fire safety. That's all. At nuclear plants. Some nuclear operators, according to the report, use unapproved fire safety manuals, rely on interim temporary fixes in response to fire damage instead of making permanent repairs, use fire protective wraps around electrical wires without having conducted needed fire endurance tests on the material. The nuclear industry had no immediate comment on the report. And 9 high-profile passport files were accessed more than 100 times, according to a new report from the State Department's Inspector General. Officials will not release the list of high-profile individuals, i.e. celebrities, whose passports were repeatedly accessed, but CBS News learned that one of the most frequently accessed files was that of Beyoncé Knowles. Inspector General's report indicated the agency's oversight of passport files had, quote, many control weaknesses, including a general lack of policies, procedures, guidance, and training, unquote. That is general. That is a general lack, who I think is running the whole deal. The agency was also criticized for having no standardized response or disciplinary process for employees who breach personal files. The State Department agreed with 19 of the Inspector General's 22 recommendations. News of the Inspector General. Ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The news from Africa, 3 West African bushmen recruited to build an authentic mud hut village at a museum in Virginia were denied visas because they are too poor and inarticulate. One applicant, they couldn't articulate anything about the project, according to the chief of the consular section for the United States in Nigeria. The museum had been planning to build a mid-1700s West African compound to illustrate the history of the slave trade as well as the early American frontier. They were denied because they were considered poor dirt farmers who live in mud huts and can't speak English and supposedly have no business in America, said a spokesperson for the museum. They couldn't articulate fully while they were coming here, but he said the whole point of recruiting the Bushmen was that they built and lived in mud huts and so possessed the skills to construct an authentic compound. In news of other Bushmen, Condoleezza Rice said this week she's proud of the Iraq War. She may change her tune when she writes her book. But in the meantime, we don't have her book. We do have her song from Songs of the Bushmen.
Every morning we'd be in the gym. Me and him, me and him. Exercising while we talked. As if we walked, as if we walked. I'd explain the world to him. In the gym, in the gym. Ever more intimate we grew, just we two, me and double you. And then we'd go back to our desks in command as we planned. Exercycle mornings were the best while we stressed to save the West. mulling secret plans to change the world, while my hair stayed primly curled. Jim, Bugs, just the press and me. No gifts or taxes could buy a gal such access. Jim, Buds, but how soon I learned. Mornings to me he'd respond, but by noon he'd been neocond. Maybe I should just have tuned out George's siren calls, stayed in halls, ivy walls. Something told me this was sink or swim. Be with him in the gym. So I decided I'd stay for the second turn. Turn the worm, keep the perm. I would leave the White House, move to state. I'd be great, not second rate. I'd fly the miles, use my wiles, my gap-toothed smiles, my secret files. I'd restore what we decreased, the missing piece in the Middle East. Meeting with world leaders, just the ones we like. A quick strike, then back on the bike. Jim, Bugs, just the press and me. But now, that foggy bottom, his ears I no longer got him. Jim, Bugs, but how soon I learned. Mornings to me he'd respond, but by noon he'd been. All too soon our time remaining grew so very slim. Prospects dim, me and him. Our chats on video had grown so grim. Without the vim of the gym.
She asked me what I made.
Mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law. If she leaves us alone, we'll have a happy home. Sent from down below, my mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, always on the edge of progress, we are in this fine century. A U.S. company now claims it's ready to build a microwave ray gun able to beam sound directly into people's heads. Can you hear me now? The device, dubbed Mob Excess Deterrent Using Silent Audio, or Medusa, exploits the microwave audio effect in which short microwave pulses rapidly heat tissue, such as the tissue inside your head, causing a shockwave inside the skull that can be detected by the ears. A series of pulses can be transmitted to produce recognizable sounds. Yeah. What could be wrong with that? The device is aimed for military or crowd control applications, but, according to New Scientist, may have other uses. Screw that HD radio. We'll just broadcast right into your skull. Can't tune us out then, can you? Lev Sadovnik of the Sierra Nevada Corporation here in our fine United States is working on the system. He's got a Navy research contract. The Navy's report says the effect was shown to be effective. Hence the name effect. Medusa induces a microwave auditory effect loud enough to cause discomfort or even incapacitation. Bet you'll tune in next time, won't you? Sadovnik says that normal audio safety limits do not apply since the sound doesn't enter through the eardrums. Oh, it just heats your brain tissue is all. The effect is a combination of loudness and the irritation factor, he says. You can't block it out. The beam can be configured either very broadly as a narrow beam or aim at multiple targets simultaneously. It could have non-military applications. That's good news. Birds seem to be highly sensitive to microwave audio, so it might be used to scare away unwanted flocks. Yeah, we haven't done enough of that. Haven't scared enough animals with our radiation yet. Sadovnik has also experimented with transmitting microwave audio to people with outer ear problems that impair their normal hearing. Yep, it's going to help. I would, says James Lynn of the University of Illinois in Chicago, I would worry about what other health effects it is having. You might see neural damage. All right, then. We'll watch for that. Watch for neural damage, ladies and gentlemen. It's coming your way soon. You know that after the untimely passing of Tim Russert, NBC spent a little time trying to figure out who would replace him as the host of Meet the Press before settling on as the interim replacement during the period up to and including the election, Tom Brokaw. Now, this weekend, I believe Meet the Press was preempted for Wimbledon, which gave them time to do some rehearsing.
Okay, people, we're starting rehearsal. Voiceover introduction is rolling. And in 3, 2.
Hello, and welcome to Meet the Press. This weekend, we celebrate the anniversary of this nation's liberation and the last pause before election season kicks into high. Tony?
Yes, Tom? It's not about the L's in the copy, is it?
No, no, they're fine. I think they're working for me.
They sound great in here.
No, this is linking back to what we were talking about in the meeting, about trying to differentiate my Meet the Press from Tim's.
Yes, sir.
And you know, I was just thinking, I'm sitting.
Yes, sir.
Tim used to sit.
Yes, he did. Sat wonderfully.
Well, maybe the best sitter ever. That's what I mean. Maybe I shouldn't have sit.
I'm coming out there.
That's a five.
Okay, is the chair wrong?
No, the chair is fine. I'm just saying, nothing says a new Meet the Press more than me not sitting.
Well, if you're not sitting, what are you doing?
I'm standing. Tell me, when did my nightly broadcast begin to move away from the pack?
I don't know, Tom. Around Monica Lewinsky time?
It was around the same time, but it was when I started standing.
Tom, we've got to get our shots set, and the crew's got lunch coming up, so...
Peter was sitting. Dan was sitting. The only network that offered you a choice was NBC. Mm-hmm. Believe me, I fought the whole idea tooth and nail. I thought, anchors sit, reporters stand. I thought it would degrade the anchor brand. But after just a couple of weeks of getting into the habit of standing, my comfort level kicked in, and you could see the ratings respond.
We weren't always standing. I distinctly remember...
Oh, sure. No, we'd mix it up. A block at the desk, B block standing, then C block back at the desk. You didn't want to become too predictable. It's still working for Brian.
Meet the Press is an hour long. Do you want to stand for an hour?
We could do the first segment standing, then I could come sit down with the guests for the second segment, and I'll get up and stand with the panel.
Is the panel standing?
No, the panel's sitting. I'm walking among them like an interlocutor.
I'm sorry, like a what?
Interlocutor. Sandy, tell him.
He's saying interlocutor.
Got it. I don't know if we can program any of the cameras to move with you on such short...
All right, then I'm standing for the whole thing. I'm not moving. I'm just standing.
It's a lot of standing.
I'll sit during the commercials.
Look, Tom, we could just change the lighting on the set. That would say, look, this isn't Tim's lighting. Mm-hmm. It isn't his show.
No, lighting is inside baseball. Any Jonathan Sixpack in anywhere USA can see that I'm not sitting.
And the guest is sitting?
Oh, sure. You don't want to mess with that. That's classic.
Okay. I'm just trying to visualize it.
Well, here. Let me do it. I'll just get up. Buchanan stays seated.
That okay with you, Pat?
Sure. I'm just standing in for the senator. Or sitting in.
Okay, let's just see how it works.
With me today is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy. Senator, welcome to Meet the Press.
Thanks, Tom. I didn't realize how tall you are.
Well, don't call attention to it. Just act as if this is how we always do it. Senator, in the case of the United States attorneys laid off by the Justice Department, do you have plans to subpoena?
It looks prosecutorial. It looks like you're the DA and he's the witness.
Like he's O.J.
Well, O.J. didn't testify, but if he had, yeah.
And we don't like that look because...
I don't know. Tim's thing was businesslike with the big desk and everything, but there was a slight warmth to it. I think that was because of the sitting. You want to lose the desk?
Mm. Stephanopoulos tried that. Look awfully awkward. Papers on laps, that sort of thing. I really think sitting puts me in Tim's bailiwick. Standing, I'm in my own...
wheelhouse. Just to help me with this. Here's Pat as the senator. He's sitting here at the desk.
I follow.
Sorry?
I said I follow.
Got it. Now, you're over here, standing beside the desk, right?
Maybe I walk over to this corner so I'm not even near the desk.
Okay. That helps me with why you're not sitting at the desk, but why are you all the way over there?
Doesn't that give you a good shot across Pat at me standing?
Oh, shot-wise, it's beautiful. I'm just asking myself, why is he over there? It's like, are you scared of the desk?
Look, see, if I'm over here, I'm going to lean on the desk. That looks all lawyerly.
Well, what?
All prosecutorial.
Got it.
See, we're the only Sunday show where if you want to see the moderator standing and asking questions, that's what we give you. I just think that's a big plus. And if we look prosecutorial, then, you know, maybe the actual questioning can get a little gentler to balance it out. You know, because it's still a tough look.
Yeah, it is. It is a tough look.
Look, I know I'm just supposed to be sitting here.
No, Brother Buchanan, way in here.
Well, I've got to do a shot on Hardball in 4 minutes. Mm. You guys figure it out. By that time, I'll be back.
That's a good idea, because I think I need to get New York to sign off on this.
You do that.
That's lunch.
Red.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? It's not hard. It's
soft. Listen to the warm.
It's not just about climate change anymore. Besides loading the atmosphere with heat-trapping greenhouse gases, human emissions of carbon dioxide have also begun to alter the chemistry of the ocean. What else is left? The ecological and economic consequences are difficult to predict, but possibly calamitous. That's from a team of chemical oceanographers in the July 4th issue of Science. Halting the changes already underway will require even steeper cuts in carbon emissions currently proposed, because those are so easy to achieve. The two co-authors note that the oceans have absorbed about 40% of the carbon dioxide emitted by humans over the past two centuries. That has slowed global warming, but the serious cost has been the ocean's average surface acidity to shift about 0.1 unit from pre-industrial levels. Depending on the rate and magnitude of future emissions, the ocean's pH could drop by as much as 0.35 units by mid-century. This acidification can damage marine organisms. Experiments have shown that changes of a little as 0.2 to 0.3 units can hamper the ability of key marine organisms such as corals and plankton to calcify their skeletons, which are built from sensitive carbonate materials. Large areas of the ocean are in danger of exceeding these levels. So aside from the air and the oceans, we haven't screwed anything up. Rising temperatures look set to produce male-only offspring in the Tuatara, condemning the ancient reptile species to extinction by 2085, according to computer models. Researchers studying Tuatara, the ancient relatives of which roamed the world alongside dinosaurs more than 200 million years ago, I think they mean 5,000 years ago. I don't think they've read the latest books in Kansas about this. They made their doomsday prediction, say these researchers, using digital maps detailing the consequences for the reptiles' nesting sites of a 4-degree centigrade hike in average temperatures. The average population of the beast is now effectively trapped on about 30 small islands in the north of New Zealand. They've been wiped out elsewhere by predators. They therefore have nowhere to go to adapt by fleeing to cooler climes. This is in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Down Australia way, an effective response to climate change must take shape and be in place in the next few years, according to the top climate change advisor of the Australian government, Professor Ross Garnaut, at a 600-page report on climate change. Speaking at the launch of the report, he says climate change is a, quote, diabolical, end quote, policy problem. That means devilish, doesn't it? Does that mean Tommy Mottola has anything to do with this? While an effective response to the challenge...
He's very, very, very devilish.
While an effective response to the challenge would play out over the many decades, it must take shape and be in place over the next few years, Dr. Garnaut says. Without early and strong action sometime before 2030, we will realize we have indelibly surrendered to forces that have moved beyond our control. He says climate change is the hardest policy problem in living memory, unquote. Biofuels have forced global food prices up by 75%, far more than previously estimated, according to a confidential World Bank report obtained by the British newspaper The Guardian. The unpublished assessment is based on the most detailed analysis of the food crisis. It emphatically contradicts the U.S. government's claims that plant-derived fuels contribute less than 3% to food price rises. It will add to pressure on governments in Europe and in D.C., which have turned to plant-derived fuels to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases to reduce their dependence on imported oil. And air travel in the tropics is worse for the climate than air travel in the more temperate zones, for reasons I don't want to go into. And, oh, yes, like the proverbial canary in the coal mine, penguins are sounding the alarm for potentially catastrophic changes in the world's oceans. The culprit isn't only climate change, says a Washington University conservation biologist. There's also oil pollution, depletion of fisheries, and rampant coastline development. But, you know, if you miss penguins, there are always menthol cigarette commercials to remind us of what they used to look like. Mm-hmm. That's going to put the flip-top cap on this edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations, over NPR Worldwide, throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on the imminently combining XM and Sirius satellite radio facilities, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/theshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like keeping the penguins around if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much, huh? And happy birthday to our nation of more than 300 people. The email address for this broadcast and playlists of the music heard on this broadcast, they're all available at harryshearer.com, along with information on how you can purchase Songs of the Bushmen, which goes on sale, good Lord, this week. Why didn't anybody tell me? The role of Condoleezza Rice was played by Judith Owen. A tip at Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desk, and to Jenny here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans. Jenny Lawson, as a matter of fact. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions that originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Now, you homeless, you go home now.